Well, I don't know about you, but in our family, we have a tradition. Any puzzlers at Christmas? A few. Excellent. All right. Welcome to the puzzling team. We don't do it any other time of year. It's like at Christmas, we will bring out a table. Some of us become rather obsessed with it to the point where it's like, man, my back is sore leaning over this table. We've dealt with all that. And as the years have gone on, we've done increasingly challenging puzzles. Like a few years ago, we did this one. I can't remember how many thousands of pieces, but it was like we had a ping pong table, and it just was like this massive puzzle. And I remember it's like we're through Christmas, like we're through New Year's. It was like this thing's never going to end. We did eventually finish it. Last year, Ben and Marissa gave me the world's most difficult puzzle for Christmas, which is a double-sided puzzle. Each piece has a picture of the other side, but a different part of it. And so the puzzle can actually be done in two separate ways. And so just as you're getting all this progress, then you realize it's like, oh no, like the whole thing is like upside down and backwards. And so, that was exciting. This year we reverted back to like something simpler. This is just like old time simple Christmas. Like just give me a box, give me a puzzle. 1,000 pieces, no more, one-sided, simple. But as we were doing it, we started with the edge, because that's kind of typical sort of how you do those kind of things. I realized really quickly on our box, this is not the box. I found this one here, because we have a puzzle exchange thing going on downstairs at the office. I don't know if you ever noticed that, but if you're into puzzling, go that way sometime. This one has no pieces. I don't know. Whoever took this puzzle and did it, you stole the pieces. You returned the box empty. But that's like a puzzle. That's how it's supposed to look on the front, right? You get your picture, it's like a map, right? And so I'm the kind of guy, I do puzzles like this. I'm like looking for a piece and then put it in. The puzzle we're doing this year has a big brand of the company right there. And so we're doing the edge, and I'm like, now I know I could have just looked at the pieces and fit it all together. It's actually not rocket science, and many of you don't even look at this when you're doing puzzles. But for me, it's like I was almost sort of paralyzed until Linda discovered inside there was actually like a whole full picture that you could pull out. So we were saved. Christmas is saved. It's all going to be just fine. But I kind of wanted to start that way because what I want to do this morning, we've been talking about Jesus as King and what it means as Christmas kind of rolls around, that so much of what the Christmas story helps us understand is that he came to fulfill all the Old Testament prophecies that he is the one, the coming king, the coming Christ that God had promised. And so they had hundreds of years of prophecies of where he was going to be born and even to some degree when he would be born. And so we get all these details. But in some ways, when you go through the Old Testament picture, it's kind of like a puzzle. It's almost like you get pieces of the picture, but not the cover of the box. And so as the Jewish people were coming to understand who the Messiah was, they would have all these different pieces, but it's like they couldn't quite figure out where do the pieces fit and what will the picture look like. In fact, many of them thought like, well, the pieces actually can't go together. This can't be just one person. And so by the time Jesus came, there were some Jewish people who thought, well, there must be multiple messiahs because the pieces just don't seem to all fit. And what I want to do this morning is I want to take 8 pieces of the puzzle and I want to show you how they fit together and how Jesus fulfills them all perfectly so that as we come to celebrate Christmas, our understanding of Jesus is more full, but more importantly than that, our worship and awe of who he is and God's incredible plan is more complete. And I hope even for us at that personal level that when we understand that God's plan for all of history and humanity is so perfect, that we can understand that his plan for our lives is going to be perfect too. Even when we don't see, it's like, how is the peace that I'm living right now going to fit with the rest of what I'm going through? Because I think that's often how life feels, right? Where we just look and it's like, the pieces don't seem like they're going to fit together into a beautiful picture. But God is at work and he is faithful and he's good and they will. And so as we come to understand, I think this bigger picture, I hope it gives us confidence in terms of the smaller picture of our lives. And that's my hope and prayer this morning. Let me read you just a strange verse to start on in Acts chapter 9. Just listen as we've been thinking about the Christ, the one who is promised. And that's the language, the Messiah in Greek. It's the Christ. This is the term. So listen to what the early believers were doing. This is Acts chapter 9. This is Saul before he's become Paul, essentially. For some days, he was with the disciples at Damascus. This is after he's met Jesus on the road. This is Acts chapter 9, verse 20. And immediately he proclaimed Jesus in the synagogue, saying, "He is the Son of God." This is Paul. Like, instantly, he's been on the road. Now he's going to start proclaiming he's the Son of God. And all who heard it were amazed and said, "Isn't this the man who made havoc in Jerusalem of those who called upon his name?" In other words, like, this guy here saying Jesus is the Son of God just a little while ago was throwing people in prison who believe Jesus is the Son of God. What's going on? This is confusing. And here's how it continues. "And has he come here, has he not come here for this purpose to bring them bound before the chief priests? But Saul increased all the more in strength and confounded the Jews who lived in Damascus by proving that Jesus was the Christ." Isn't that interesting? What is Saul up to in Damascus? What is God empowering Saul to do? Proving one thing. Jesus is the Christ. He is the one that fulfilled all of the pieces of the Old Testament. So what are our pieces? Piece number one. We've dealt with this one a fair bit over the last couple of weeks. The first piece of the puzzle from the Old Testament is that the Messiah, the Christ, was going to be a king. And he was going to come from the specific family line of David. So the great king of Israel would have an heir to the throne. And so the Jewish people were looking for a king who would come from that family line who would reign over the nation of Israel. You can go back all through the Old Testament. Like I said, we're not going to stop too long on this one because we've been here quite a bit. But you would see over and over again in the Old Testament, it's this hope, this expectation. Places like 2 Samuel 7 are big on this. But all through the prophets, we're looking for a king. And he will come from the family line of David, from the family line of Judah, all the way back to Genesis chapter 49. And so they were on the hunt for a king. Now, let me read you something. This isn't a Bible. This is just someone else writing, a Jewish person writing. So it'd be just like a book you could get out of the library today. It's not what God says. This is just someone living just before Jesus, writing about what they thought or expected the Messiah was going to be like, all right? But it gives us an idea of what were the Jews thinking? What were they expecting in terms of this Messiah who was to come? Here's what one book says. "Taught by God, the Messiah will be a righteous king over the Gentiles. There will be no unrighteousness among them in his days. He will be holy. Their king will be the Lord. He will be the Messiah. He will not rely on a horse or rider or bow. He will not collect gold and silver for war. He will be compassionate to all the nations who reverently stand before him. And he himself will be free from sin in order to rule a great people. And he will expose officials and drive out sinners by the strength of his word." There it is, before Jesus was born. This is not the Old Testament. This is just Jewish people trying to put together the pieces of what will this king be like. And as you hear the description, I don't know if you're like me, you're going, that is a perfect description of who Jesus is. Sinless, powerful, reaching out to the nations, who doesn't raise an army and doesn't collect taxes to arm people. He conquers with the power of his word, with his testimony, what he says and what is true. So we come into the New Testament and you see the stories, you see the things going on about Jesus. You hear this issue over and over and over again. Listen to Matthew 22, verse 42. "What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is him? Is he, sorry?" And they said to him, so this is Jesus saying, "What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is him? Is he?" And here's the answer. He's the son of David. They know it. They're looking for the son of David who's going to be their king. We could go so many places. You go in John chapter 7, there's a big discussion about the Christ. Others said, here's what they said, "This is the Christ," but some said, "Is the Christ to come from Galilee?" And you hear what they're getting at. You hear what they're going, well, the Christ can't come from Galilee because that's not where David comes from. The king has to come from Bethlehem. And Jesus came from Galilee. They didn't know the whole story, did they? They didn't know that Jesus was born in Bethlehem and raised in Galilee. And so they're having trouble putting the pieces together of this whole situation. But Jesus was the one who was born in the family line of David, perfectly fulfilling piece number one. Piece number two. He would be the prophet. Now, this we don't often talk about this one, do we? Jesus, the prophet? If you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 18, Moses is speaking and he says something like this. There will one day come the prophet. Not a prophet. It's very, very interesting. There will be lots of a prophets who come and they will speak on behalf of God. But Deuteronomy chapter 18 gives us this expectation that one day there will come one particular prophet who will speak on behalf of God. Now, we know that Jesus is that prophet because he is God. So he doesn't just speak on behalf of God. He is God, and when he speaks, God is speaking. But all through the Old Testament, and again, all through the Jewish expectations of the Messiah, they are looking for the prophet. John the Baptist comes along, and here's what they say about him. You can go to places like John chapter 7 and chapter 6 and these kind of places, John chapter 1. John starts preaching, and they come to John, the Jewish people, and here's what they say to him. Are you the prophet? Isn't that interesting? Not a prophet, the prophet. Prophet. We are looking for the prophet. We know he was promised. We know he was promised back in Deuteronomy chapter 18. And in John chapter 7, when people start hearing Jesus speaking, here's what they say of him. This is the prophet. You hear what they're saying? They're saying, we found Messiah. We have found the Christ. This is him. He is both king, fulfilling perfectly peace number one, and prophet, fulfilling peace number two, because as I remind you, he is God. Prophets spoke on behalf of God, so what would the supreme, ultimate prophet need to be? He would need to be God, speaking the very words of God, and that is who Jesus is. Piece number three, Jesus is the priest. Now, for those of you who know your Old Testament, this is where things start to get really tricky. Because you would know that to be from the family line of David in order to be king and from the family line of Aaron in order to be a priest are two separate families. You can't be both. It's genetically impossible. You have to be one or the other. And yet there is this expectation all through the Old Testament that the Messiah will be a priest. In fact, this becomes one of the stumbling blocks for the people as they're trying to understand. It's like, how can the Messiah be our king and our priest? He's got to be one or the other. In fact, if you've heard of Qumran and the Qumran scrolls that were found over the last, about 40 years ago, the Qumran community actually decided there would be two messiahs, one kingly and one priestly, because you just simply couldn't be both at the same time. And yet when you go and you read Psalm chapter 110, you will see all through this psalm, both things are going on about seemingly one person. He's kingly and he's priestly. And all through the psalm, you get this strange tension. It's not going to be two people. It's going to be one. And as you come again into the New Testament and you begin to understand who Jesus is, you'll see Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, wrestling with this whole question of how is Jesus king and how is he priest? And we discover that there's actually an older priestly line, the priesthood of Melchizedek. And some of us read Hebrews and we're going, what does Melchizedek have to do with Jesus in the New Testament? But the point that Hebrews is making is that Jesus is not a priest from the family line of Aaron. That actually would be impossible. He's a priest from the line of Melchizedek, who will be a priest forever. Now, the priests in the Old Testament, they had a role of offering sacrifice for sins. That was their job. And now we understand that when Jesus comes, he comes as the ultimate priest because he comes to offer himself as a sacrifice for sin. And so he is a king come to rule. He is a prophet come to speak the words of God because he's God. And he is the ultimate priest because he comes to give himself as a sacrifice for sin. Those are the first three pieces of this puzzle of what the Messiah looks like in the Old Testament. Piece number four, and here's where things get even trickier. The Messiah starts to sound in the Old Testament like God himself. When you go and you read through the descriptions of the Messiah in Daniel, you'll find that people start worshiping the Messiah. Now, if you know Jewish background, if you know your Ten Commandments even, you would know that in the Jewish world and even in our Christian world, you don't worship anyone other than God. So when we worship Jesus, we are recognizing him as God. So you get through the Old Testament and you're reading through Daniel and they start worshiping the Messiah. And if you are a kind of sort of thoughtful person working through this, you're going, hold on a second. The moment they begin to worship, you remember in Daniel itself, Daniel and his friends are the ones who are willing to give up their lives to not worship a person. They will not worship the king, even if it means death. And yet all of a sudden in Daniel chapter 7 and then on through Daniel chapter 9, you find people worshiping the Messiah. And you all of a sudden start to put the pieces together. Piece number four means that the Messiah actually has to be God himself for all these pieces to fit. Now, in the Gospels, when you open up into Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you come across a really strange name for Jesus. It's actually the main phrase he uses to describe himself. He is the Son of Man, which sounds like he's saying, it's like, don't confuse anything. I'm not God. I'm just a really ordinary guy, right? Most of us, if you hear Son of Man, you think he's saying, I'm just human. That's actually the complete opposite of what that title means. It's a title from Daniel chapter 7, the very moment where Daniel is telling us that people worship the Messiah. And Jesus grabs hold of that title and says, this is who I am. Now, if you go and again read through the stories in the New Testament of Jesus when he begins to reveal himself, something amazing happens. Those who see him most closely, his disciples, they actually begin to worship him. You go read it sometime. There are multiple occasions where the disciples stop. In the moment when they're on a boat and there's a storm and he calms the storm, they are in awe. And what do they do next? They worship him. Because what's happened? They have recognized that he is God. He is the Messiah. And piece number four has come into focus for them. Now, one other quick thing on piece number four is that there is another little phrase that becomes really, really important. And so for us who are kind of leaning into that sort of academic part of things, there's a phrase of Jesus sitting at the right hand of God. Anyone heard of that phrase? Jesus, the right hand of God? All through the New Testament. Just go read it sometime and watch for it. It's going to show up lots. It's an interesting little phrase. It kind of seems like God's kind of the main, he's in command, and Jesus is kind of like the assistant, the right hand. Isn't that how we would kind of use it? It's like, huh, that's my right hand guy. Right? That's not actually what it means when you read it in biblical context. There's a principle of biblical interpretation called the principle of first usage. In other words, whenever the word gets used first, that kind of gives it its best definition. So the word love in our Bibles is first used actually in Genesis chapter 22, when Abraham takes his son Isaac and he's going to offer him as a sacrifice, obeying God, and he's going to actually put his son to death. And Abraham is convinced that God is going to work through the life of Isaac. And so he concludes, even if he puts Isaac to death, God is going to raise him back to life again, because that's the only thing he can think of. He doesn't understand that God actually is going to stop this whole plan before he gets to that point. But it's in that moment in Genesis chapter 22, we find out Abraham loved his son. This principle of first use then makes a ton of sense when you start to see how the New Testament uses the word love. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. You want to know what love looks like? You start in Genesis chapter 22 with a father who loves his son so much, but is still willing, if God had asked him, to put him to death. And you move to the New Testament with a God, a father who loved his son so much, but this time would actually allow his son to die for us. That's the principle of first use. Now, the principle of first use for at your right hand is actually back to a story we've studied a couple years back in the life of Jacob. And you'll see the very first time it's used is actually when Joseph brings his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And if you remember this moment, he kind of arranges them so that Jacob will put his right hand on the oldest son. And Jacob actually reaches across in a really weird moment and puts his hand on the younger son and blesses him, because that right hand is actually the indicator of great honor and power and authority. And Jesus being the right hand of God is not to say he's like God's helper. It's actually saying he is the one with power and authority above all things. To be at the right hand of God essentially is to be God. As you read through your New Testament sometime with that kind of understanding in mind, the lights will start coming on for you as you read through the statements, particularly around his crucifixion, when he is arrested and then put on trial, because multiple times the conversation comes back to this point of right hand. He's at the right hand. This is a big deal. If Jesus is at the right hand, it means he's the Messiah, and it means he is essentially God. Let me just read you a couple so you get a taste of what that looks like. Sorry. Oh, here we go. Well, this is afterward. Well, no, here, I'll read this one. This is Luke 24. Jesus said, "When I was with you, I told you everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets must be fulfilled. Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures." This is after his resurrection. Now they understand. "And he said, yes, it was written long ago, the Messiah must suffer and die and rise from the dead on the third day. And it was written that this message would be proclaimed in the authority of his name to all the nations, beginning in Jerusalem. There is forgiveness of sins for all who repent. You are witness to these things." And when the leaders were brought before Israel, This is when they began to say, Jesus is at the right hand of God. And so if you go to Acts chapter 2, you've got Peter at the feast. He's going to declare that Jesus sits at the right hand of God. You get Stephen, who's being put to death. You want to know one of the last things he said? Jesus is at the right hand of God. These are the believers who are saying Jesus at the right hand of God means he's the Messiah and he is God. This is how Paul says it in Romans chapter 8. Who will condemn us? No one. For Jesus died for us, was raised to life for us, and is sitting at the place of honor at God's right hand. He's the Messiah. He's God. All right, there's lots more examples of that, but that kind of deals with number 4 real quick, that he is God. Number 5, what is another piece of the puzzle? We're getting quick here. Number 5 is the Jews were expecting their Messiah to be able to do miracles. And when the Messiah came, he would be a miracle-working Messiah. You see this actually show up in a lot of the conversations when people come to Jesus and they're trying to sort out who he is. Listen to what John chapter 7 says. Many people believed in him. This is verse 31. They said, when the Christ appears, will he do more signs than this man? Kind of hear how the logic goes? Like Jesus is doing a lot of miracles. Do we think the Messiah will do more? No, this must be the Christ, the Messiah. John the Baptist, yeah, when he was in prison in Matthew chapter 11, he's kind of going, is Jesus the Messiah? Is he not? What? Did I get it wrong? And he sends messengers to Jesus, and he really essentially asks the question, are you the one? And Jesus' response, recorded for us, is essentially to say, tell him what you have heard and seen. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, the deaf hear. Right? I am a miracle-working God. What's interesting at that moment, he's quoting from Isaiah chapter 42:7. And Isaiah chapter 42:7, at the end of that list is, and the prisoners are set free. You want to know what he leaves off for John the Baptist? He leaves off that part. It's as though he's saying to John, John, you're going to have to trust me. I am powerful enough to work miracles whenever it is the right thing to do. But John, there isn't always a miracle. There's not always a miracle. You're going to have to trust me on this one. So Jesus is a miracle-working Messiah. Paul says to the Corinthians, the Jews demand signs and the Greeks demand wisdom. You hear that? The Jews are demanding signs. Why are they demanding signs? Because it was going to be the authenticity of the Messiah. Jesus is a miracle-working Messiah. Number 6, he is a suffering Messiah. This is a hard one to fit into all the other pieces, right? It's like, how can he be a king and suffer? Shouldn't a king be triumphant? You go read in Isaiah chapter 53. You will see that Isaiah is speaking of the Messiah in that case, the one who will come and he will suffer. In fact, when you read Isaiah chapter 53 with eyes wide open, you will find out that Isaiah actually is describing the death of the Messiah. And yet, the life of the Messiah that continues after. It's a shocking passage. In other words, Isaiah 53 tells us plainly the Messiah will die and be raised to life again, and he will be a suffering Messiah. In Matthew chapter 27, Pilate said to them, what will I do with Jesus who is called the Christ? And they all said, let him be crucified. But you know how the story ends. He does not stay dead. Number 7, he will be a forever Messiah. His reign will not end. In fact, this becomes a stumbling block in John chapter 12, verse 34. Sorry. The crowds answered him, we have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man will be lifted up? You see, when Jesus says, I will be lifted up, they understand what he's saying. They understand that he is saying, I will die. And they can't put the pieces together. We know when the Messiah, when the Christ comes, he will be forever. And yet you say you are going to be lifted up. It doesn't seem to fit. They haven't yet come to understand that when Jesus says he will be lifted up, he also says he will be raised to life again. He will reign forever. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 7, he will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and holding with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. Lastly, piece number 8, and then we're done. He's a saving Messiah. In fact, I'm convinced if you go and read through the Old Testament, you want to know the main idea in the mind of the Jewish people of who their Messiah will be. He will be one who comes to save them. In fact, the word redeemer will show up often around this concept of Messiah. Just like God redeemed his people from Egypt when they were slaves, the Messiah was going to come and he would redeem his people yet again. Now, the Jewish people were thinking from Rome, or from some oppressive nation. They didn't have in their minds from sin and death and Satan. And so when Palm Sunday comes up and the people are shouting, Hosanna. They're saying, that word means we're saved. They are announcing as Jesus walks into Jerusalem, we found the Messiah. We're finally saved. And yet shortly after, they will put him on a cross and he will be put to death. As he's on the cross, there are some very, very strange conversations. I'll let you read them sometime. One of them goes like this. A group of people watching Jesus on the cross, let the Christ, the King of Israel, hear what they're saying? You hear? Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down from the cross that we may see and believe. A short time after that, someone says these words. If he essentially can't save himself, how will he save us, right? So he's on the cross. Let him save himself, and then we will know he can save us. Totally unaware that it's on the cross he is saving us. The salvation that we needed most desperately was not from some sort of oppressive foreign power. The salvation we needed, that I needed, was from a sinful, dead heart that did not seek after God, that was separated from God and would have been forever had Jesus not come as the Christ, my King, who would die on a cross for me. And that's the good news that we get to celebrate at Christmas. The one who is dying on a cross and seems powerless is powerful. When they put the thorn of crowns on his head, mocking him as king, he actually is king. King of kings, the long-awaited king. And the one who they thought could not save himself was saving us. This afternoon, we get a chance yet again as a church family to share that awesome news with our community. We get to share the hope and joy of Jesus Christ, the good news that he has come to save us from our sins and to reconcile us to God. And so I'm going to pray for us as we prepare for that. And then we are going to head home and get a few minutes of rest, a little bit of food before you get another bowl of chili yet again tonight. Turns out man cannot live by bread, but he can live by chili. But it's been great being together this morning. Thank you for being with us. Let me pray for you. Father, we thank you for your son, Jesus Christ, who is the king, the prophet, the priest, the miracle worker, the great God who came to save us.